He will tell you, perhaps, how puzzled he was when suddenly, without warning, he felt inside himself a warm, comforting feeling. How good they were, our good neighbors, the good people. They took a great interest in the affairs of men, and they always stood for justice and right. They could appear in different forms. With them Joe Simonton exchanged food. So in times gone by, did Irishmen, who talked to similar beings. In those days, too, they were called the good people and, in Scotland, the good neighbors, the Slemth. What did they say, then? We are far superior to you. We could cut off half the human race. 50 It does all make sense. These were the facts we have missed, without which we could never piece the UFO jigsaw together. Priests and scholars left books about the legends of their time concerning these beings. These books had to be found, collected, and studied. They contained no solutions, only elements of great puzzlement. But this puzzlement was documented. Together, these stories presented a coherent picture of the appearance, the organization, and the methods of our strange visitors. The appearance was, docs this surprise you question mark exactly that of today's UFO pilots. The methods were the same. There was the sudden vision of brilliant houses at night, houses that could often fly, that contained peculiar lamps, radiant lights that needed no fuel. The creatures could paralyze their witnesses and translate them through time. They hunted animals and took away people. Their organization had a name, the Secret Commonwealth. In The Magic Casement, a book edited by Alfred Noyes about 1910, 1 find this little poem by William Allingham, which I would like all ufologists to learn as a tribute to Joe Simonton. Up the airy mountains, down the rushy glen, we daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men, wee folk, good folk, trooping all together, green jacket, red cap, and white owl's feather. Down along the rocky shore some make their home, they live on crispy pancakes of yellow tide foam, some in the reeds of the Black Mountain Lake, with frogs for their watchdogs, all night awake. Chapter 3. To know human life one must go deep beneath its sunny exterior, and to know that summer sea which is the fairy faith one must put on a suit of armor and dive beneath its waves and behold the rare corals and moving sea palms and all the brilliant creatures who move in and out among those corals and sea palms, and the horrible and awful creatures too, creatures which would devour the man were his armor not of steel, for they all mingle together in the depths of that sea, hidden from our view as we sail over the surface of its sunlit waters only. Walter W. Cntz, The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries. The teletype message arrived in Dayton, Ohio, on September 9, 1966, through military channels. The full text, about 4 pages long, was quite unintelligible without knowledge of the Air Force procedure for the transmission of UFO reports. The message is shortened by reference to known, standardized questions that are never repeated in the text itself, with the help of the standard questionnaire. However, it is generally possible to find out what the sender is trying to describe. This particular message had originated at Kelly Air Force Base, Texas, and was addressed to the Air Force Systems Command, Headquarters, U.S. Air Force, and the Secretary. It bore the headline Unclassified Routine and the title UFO Report is Submitted in Accordance with AFR. Kelly Air Force Base was sending something very close to a ghost story. The report made reference to 2 separate incidents, occurring, respectively, on August 6 and September 3, 1966, in a small Texas town. The author of the report is a father of 4 children. We shall call him Robert. His house is located in a fairly isolated spot, and he has never discussed the incidents with his neighbors. On August 6, the 3 youngest children, ages 6 to 9, noticed a dark object shaped like an upside-down cup. Although it was afternoon, the children had not seen the object arrive. It was dark, without color and without lights. Then a square yellow light appeared, like a door opening, and a small creature was seen in the square of light. The entity, 3 to 4 feet tall, was dressed in black clothing, which reflected a yellow or gold color. The observation lasted several minutes, then the door closed. A low humming sound became audible, and the object took off toward the northeast, rising sharply but at an unexceptional speed. These details, naturally, were not given spontaneously by the children. The story was reconstituted during the investigation. At no time did the object touch the ground. It hovered at a height of about 15 feet, near a tree, which was found undamaged, about 35 feet from the house. The second sighting took place on September 3rd. Most of the family had gone away, but the oldest daughter had remained in the house with a friend. They were watching television in the afternoon when the set snowed, then went out. The house was lit up with eerie red and yellow light, which appeared to be circling or twirling. They looked outside and saw an object hovering in the same position, by the same tree, as in the first sighting. Its shape, again, was that of an upside-down cup, with a flat disc beneath, like a saucer. It was covered with light and departed shortly afterward. No sign of life was apparent inside or outside the craft. 2 days later, Robert was propped up in bed. Through his door and across the hall he could seconds a dark doorway leading to his son's bedroom. All of a sudden he saw a small person, 3.5 to 4 feet tall, dressed in tight-fitting clothes, enter the dark bedroom. He assumed it was his small daughter going in to talk to her mother who was in the room with his sons. About 10 minutes later he saw something like a bar of light, which appeared to crumble. He got up and went to the room, where he found his wife and the boys, who had also seen the bar of light. He did not see the person in white leave, and his wife stated their daughter had not been in the room at any time. There was no physical evidence to substantiate the presence of the small person in the house. The rocks were full of them. On the island of Aramork, a man named Old Patsy, whom we met in Chapter 2, told Walter Wentz a true story about the fairies, 20 years or so ago around the bed of Ermot and Grania, just above us on the hill, there were seen many fairies, crowds of them and a single deer. They began to chase the deer, and followed it right across the island. At another time similar little people chased a horse. The rocks were full of them, and they were small fellows, another person told Wentz. My mother used to tell about seeing the fair folk dancing in the fields near Cardigan, and other people have seen them around the Cromlech up there on the hill. They appeared as little children in clothes like soldiers' clothes and with red caps, according to some accounts. While Wentz was recording material in Ireland, he went to Rattray with Dr. Hyde, and they were told this story about a leprechaun. One day I was gathering berries along a hedge not far from here and something made me turn over a flat stone which I saw in the ditch where I stood. And the beneath the stone was the most beautiful little creature I have ever seen in my life, and he in a hole as smug as could be. He wasn't much larger than a doll and he was most perfectly formed with a little mouth and eyes. I turned the stone over again and ran as hard as I could to bring my mother. But when we got back we couldn't seconds a thing of him. Now, since we are getting to the central idea of this book, I will quote two more stories, both of them landing reports from the richest period, in terms of number of landings reported, autumn, 1954, in UCO history. Both stories come from France. The first case took place on October 9. Four children living in Pont-Oil at Chetive, Moselle, reported that at about 6:30 p.m., as they were roller skating, they suddenly saw something luminous near the cemetery. It was a round machine, about 2.5 meters in diameter, which was standing on three legs. Soon a man came out. He was holding a lighted flashlight in his hand and it blinded us. But we could see that he had large eyes, a face covered with hair and that he was very small, about 4 feet tall. Lai was dressed in a sort of black sack like the cassock M. Le Cuers. He looked at us and said something we did not understand. He turned off the flashlight. We became afraid and ran away. When we looked back we saw something in the sky. It was very high, very bright and flew fast. The second case is a classic one. It happened on Sunday, September 26, in Chabkill, Drôme. At about 2:30 p.m., Mrs. Leboeuf, was gathering blackberries along a hedge. Yes, it is almost the exact duplication of the leprechaun story, when the dog began to bark and then started howling miserably. She looked around and saw the little animal standing at the edge of a wheat field, in front of something that she thought at first was a scarecrow. But going closer, she saw that the scarecrow was some kind of small diving suit, made of translucent plastic material, 3 feet tall or a little taller, with a head that was also translucent. And suddenly she realized that inside the diving suit was a thing, and that behind the blurred transparency of the helmet, two eyes were looking at her. At least she had the impression of eyes, but they seemed larger than human eyes. As she realized this, the diving suit began to move toward her, with a kind of quick, waddling gait. At this point, Mrs. Leboeuf fled in terror and hid in a nearby thicket. When she tried to locate the entity, there was nothing to be seen, but all the dogs in the village were furiously barking. All of a sudden, a large metallic, circular object rose from behind some trees and took off toward the northeast. People who had heard the witnesses' cries soon gathered around her. At the site where the disc had been seen to rise, a circle was found, about 10 feet in diameter, where shrubs and bushes had been crushed. From one of the acacia trees at the edge of this circular imprint hung down a branch more than 3 inches thick, broken by pressure from above. The branch of another acacia, which hung over the circular mark 8.5 feet above the ground, was entirely stripped of its leaves. The first few yards of wheat, in the path of the object as it took off through the field, were flattened out in radiating lines. I hardly need underline the similarity between the depression left by this object and the various kinds of rings or nests we have already studied. Let us now return to the Pans, the dwarfish race that accompanies the Corrigans, the fairies of Brittany. They are seen only at twilight or at night. Some carry a torch like a Welsh death candle. They have swords no bigger than pins. According to Vilmark, a careful distinction should be drawn between Corrigans and dwarfs. The latter are a hideous race of beings with dark or even black hairy bodies, with voices like old men and little sparkling black eyes. A man who wrote to me after reading Anatomy of a Phenomenon pointed out that although he was unconvinced about the existence of the unidentified flying objects, he had discovered something he thought might be of interest to me. And he continued thus: I have spent several years doing research on the Cherokee Indian, which is a branch of the Iroquoian tribe. When the Cherokees migrated into the hills of Tennessee, they came upon a strange race of moon-eyed people who could not see in the daylight. The Cherokees, being unable to understand these wretches, expelled them. Barton in 1797 states these people were a strange white race, far advanced, living in houses. 8 Settlers I would, 26 years later, states, the invading Cherokees found white people near the head of Little Tennessee with forts extending down as far as the Chickamauga Creek. He gives the location of 3 of these forts. Confirmation of my correspondent's report is found in the excellent book Mound Builders of Ancient America, The Archaeology of a Myth, where Robert Silverberg quotes Barton's new views of the origins of the tribes and nations of America, published in Philadelphia in 1798 and dedicated to Thomas Jefferson. The Cherokee tell us that when they first arrived in the country which they inhabit, they found it possessed by certain moon-eyed people who could not see in the daytime. These wretches were expelled. Silverberg adds that Barton left the clear implication that these albino people were responsible for the Tennessee mounds. Let us come to the point now. It would be nice to hold on to the common belief that the UFOs are craft from a superior space civilization, because this is a hypothesis science fiction has made widely acceptable, and because we are not altogether unprepared, scientifically and even, perhaps, militarily, to deal with such visitors. Unfortunately, however, the theory that flying saucers are material objects from outer space manned by a race originating on some other planet is not a complete answer. However strong the current belief in saucers from space, it cannot be stronger than the Celtic faith in the elves and the fairies, or the medieval belief in Teutons, or the fear throughout the Christian lands, in the first centuries of our era, of demons and satyrs and fauns. Certainly, it cannot be stronger than the faith that inspired the writers of the Bible, a faith rooted in daily experiences with angelic visitation. In short, by suggesting that modern UFO sightings might be the result of experiments, of a scientific or even super-scientific nature, conducted by a race of space travelers, we may be the victims of our ignorance, an ignorance that finds its cause in the fact that idiots and pedants alike, through a common reaction that psychologists could perhaps explain if they were not its first victims, have covered the fairy faith with the same ridicule as other idiots and pedants cover the UFO phenomenon. The realization that rumors of the real meaning of the UFO phenomenon set in motion the deepest and most powerful mental mechanisms makes acceptance of such facts very difficult, especially since the facts ignore frontiers, creeds, and races, defy rational statement, and turn around the most logical predictions as if they were mere toys. It is difficult to come to grips with the UFO phenomenon, for, although it clearly evolves through phases, its effects are diffuse and it cannot be dated very precisely. We have to rely on legends, hearsay, and extrapolations. Much can be accomplished, however, once it has realized that the observational material on hand since World War II, the 20,000 or so clear-cut, dated reports of UFOs in official and private files, is nothing but a resurgence of a deep stream in human culture known in older times under various other names. Whence, as we have seen, found several people in Celtic countries who had seen the gentry or had known people who were taken by fairies. In Brittany, he had much greater difficulty. The general belief in the interior of Brittany is that the fees once existed, but that they disappeared as their country was changed by modern conditions. In the region of the Mcn and the Verse, Ilet Vialn, it is said that for more than a century there have been no fees, and on the sea coast where it is firmly believed that the fees used to inhabit certain grottos in the cliffs, the opinion is that they disappeared at the beginning of the last century. The oldest Bretons say that their parents or grandparents often spoke about having seen fees, but very rarely do they say that they themselves have seen fees. M. Paul Sebillet found only two who had. One was an old needle woman of St. Cast, who had such fear of fees that if she was on her way to do some sewing in the country and it was night, she always took a long circuitous route to avoid passing near a field known as the Couvent des Fees. The other was Marie Ching, a woman 88 years old. The central question in the analysis of the UFO phenomenon has always been that of the controlling intelligence behind the object's apparently purposeful behavior. In stating the problem in such terms, I am not assuming that the objects are real, contrary to the implications someone might draw if he read this book too fast. Yet in no way am I excluding the possibility that this controlling intelligence is human, and I shall elaborate on this idea in later chapters. For the time being, let me simply state again my basic contention: the modern, global belief in flying saucers and their occupants is identical to an earlier belief in the fairy faith. The entities described as the pilots of the craft are indistinguishable from the elves, sylphs, and lutans of the Middle Ages. Through the observations of unidentified flying objects, we are concerned with an agency our ancestors knew well and regarded with terror. We are prying into the affairs of the secret commonwealth. In undertaking research into beliefs in fairies, gentry, call them what you will, confusion arises from the great variety of names and classifications given the different races of beings. In Lower Brittany alone, Paul Sebillet has found and classified 50 different names given to lutins and corrigans, while Latins themselves are the same as the Elvish people: pixies in Cornwall, Robin Goodfellows in England, Gollum in Wales, goblins in Norrumph, and brownies in Scotland. Can we establish with certainty that the two beliefs are indeed identical? I believe we can. In earlier chapters, I have already given several examples of the means of transportation used by the sylphs. The ability of the fairies to cross the continents cannot have escaped the reader's attention. In later chapters, I have several rather striking tales to tell about Indian beliefs in flying races and the aerial ships used by the gentry taking part in medieval wars. But I have not yet drawn from popular folklore the stories that support most directly the idea that strange flying objects have been seen throughout history in connection with the little people. But let us clear up this point now. Aerial races, Farfadets and Slemth. As late as 1850, one race of Lutons survived in France, in the region of Poitou, which has been in recent years a favorite landing area for flying saucers. The Lutons of Poitou were known as Farfadets, and the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris contains several delightful accounts of their mischievous deeds. What were the main characteristics of the Fadets or Farfadets? For they were little men, very black and hairy. All day long they lived in caves, and at night they liked to get close to the farms. Usually their favorite pastime was to play tricks on terrified women. Their dwellings were located with some precision. C. Puichaud, for instance, has reported in a lecture that Farfadets lived for a long time at Laboulediac near Troves, de Sèvres, in underground tunnels they had dug themselves. 5 at Laboisier. The inhabitants describe the Fadets as hairy dwarfs who played all sorts of pranks. One night in the 1850s, near the shore of the Ygre River, a group of women talked outside until about midnight. As they were returning to the village, they had just crossed a bridge, they heard a terrible noise and saw something that froze there. The verb lutincre, which means to behave like a Luton, has survived in the French language. It is used to describe childish pranks or harmless tricks played on the girls. Indeed, the Fadets were known to bother pretty girls by pulling their hats, hiding their needles, etc. One would not claim that the Lutons deserved all the credits for such actions. Some objects, which, for lack of a better term, they called a chariot with whining wheels, was speeding up the hill with a marvelous velocity. Naturally, it was pulled by the Farfadets. The terrified women hung together as they saw the apparition. One of them, although half dead with fear, made the sign of the cross. The strange chariot leapt up over the vineyard and was lost in the night. The women hurried home and told the story to their husbands, who decided to investigate. They wisely awaited dawn, however, and then bravely went to the spot as soon as the sun was up. Of course, there was nothing left to be seen. We have already been told of the traveling habits of the good people. What has not yet been mentioned is the belief, especially in Ireland, that conditions among humans are correlated to the travels of the fairies. Wentz says that, according to John Glynn, town clerk of Tuam, during 1846-47 the potato crop in Ireland was a failure and very much suffering resulted. At the time, the country people in these parts attributed the famine to disturbed conditions in the fairy world. Old Steady Stead once told me about the conditions then prevailing. Sure, we couldn't be any other way, and I saw the good people and hundreds besides me saw them fighting in the sky over Knockmandon towards Galway. And I heard others say they saw the fighting too. According to another popular Irish belief, the elves have two great feasts each year. The first one takes place at the beginning of spring, when the hero Odonoglum, who used to reign over the earth, rises through the sky on a white horse, surrounded by the brilliant company of the elves. Lucky is he, indeed, the Irishman who sees him rise from the depths of the Lake of Killarney. In January, 1537, the people of Francania, between Pabcanbap and the forest of Thorinia, saw a star of marvelous size. It came lower and lower and appeared as a large white circle from which whirlwinds and patches of fire came forth, falling to earth. The pieces of fire melted spearheads and ironwork, without causing harm to human beings or their houses. The favorite abode of the gentry, however, was not always an aerial one. In many talks related by the students of folklore, as in the literature of UFOs, the strange beings often come from the sea. Thus Wentz learned, there is an invisible island, between Innismurra and the coast opposite Grange, on which part of the gentry is supposed to reside. When it is visible, it is only visible for a short time. In the legends of Europe, it is between the 8th and the 10th centuries that celestial prodigies were most often visible. But the books on magic and demonology associate supernatural beings with celestial signs. A strange category of devils called Friday demons is described in the magical works of Henri Corneille Agrippa. These devils are of medium height, rather handsome. Their arrival is preceded by a brilliant star. According to the Western Kabbalists, the sylphs flew through the air with the speed of lightning, riding a peculiar cloud. It is noteworthy, too, that in France some fairies are supposed to bear a luminous stone, an object that is often part of the equipment of flying saucer occupants. Many a little man has a light on either his belt, chest, or helmet. In a French tradition that survives in modern novels, VI, the fortunate mortal who can steal the fairy's luminous stone is sure of lifelong happiness. On June 17, 1790, near Alencon, France, there was an apparition so strange and so disturbing that police inspector Liebeuf was instructed to make a thorough investigation. His report reads thus, in part: at 5 a.m. on June 12, several farmers caught sight of an enormous globe which seemed surrounded with flames. First they thought it was perhaps a balloon that had caught fire, but the great velocity and the whistling sound which came from that body intrigued them. The globe slowed down, made some oscillations and precipitated itself towards the top of a hill, unearthing plants along the slope. The heat which emanated from it was so intense that soon the grass and the small trees started burning. The peasants succeeded in controlling the fire which threatened to spread to the whole area. In the evening this sphere was still warm and an extraordinary thing happened, not to say an incredible thing. The witnesses were two mayors, a doctor and three other authorities who confirm my report, in addition to the dozens of peasants who were present. This sphere, which would have been large enough to contain a carriage, had not suffered from all that flight. It excited so much curiosity that people came from all parts to see it. Then all of a sudden a kind of door opened and, there is the interesting thing, a person like us came out of it, but this person was dressed in a strange way, wearing a tight-fitting suit and, seeing all that crowd, said some words which were not understood and fled into the wood. Instinctively, the peasants stepped back, in fear. And this saved them because soon after that the sphere exploded in silence, throwing pieces everywhere, and these pieces burned until they were reduced to powder. Researches were initiated to find the mysterious man, but he seemed to have dissolved. Let us follow the strange beings across the world now, to Mexico, where an American anthropologist, Brian Stross, from Berkeley, reports that the Tzotzil Indians have strange legends of their own. One night, Stross and his Indian assistant discussed these legends of their Ectles or Ictles, the little black beings, after seeing a strange light wandering about in the Mexican sky. The Ictles are 3 foot tall, hairy, black humanoids whom the natives encounter frequently, and Stross learned, about 20 years ago, or less, there were many sightings of this creature or creatures. And several people apparently tried to fight it with machetes. One man also saw a small sphere following him from about 5 feet. After many attempts he finally hit it with his machete and it disintegrated, leaving only an ash-like substance. The beings were observed in ancient times. They fly, they attack people, and, in the modern report, they carry a kind of rocket on their backs and kidnap Indians. Occasionally, Stross was told, people have been paralyzed when they came upon the Ictles, who are said to live in caves, which the natives are careful not to enter. Gordon Creighton, a staff member of the Flying Saucer Review and a former linguistic expert with the British Foreign Service, had occasion to study Indian folklore during several visits in Latin America. Commenting upon Stross's report, Creighton pointed out that words such as Ik and Ictle were found in all the dialects of the Miocene linguistic group. The Tzotzil words Ik and Ictle, the adjective form, simply mean black being or black. In the Maya language, we find that Ik means air or wind, and Ictle means a spirit, while Ik means black. The Quechua Maya, in the Altavira Paz region of Guatemala, talk of a Ik. The Gek, meaning black in the Kekchi dialect of Maya, is said to be a centaur-like being that guards his patron's house at night, and frightens people at dusk. Black, ugly, hairy, he is half-human, with human hands but the hooves of a horse. We shall return to the Eikles, or Wendis, as they are called in British Honduras, in a later chapter, in connection with another feature of their behavior.